Sehr geehrter und sehr geliebter Bischof Huber und Frau Huber, Reverend Fathers, Brothers, Sisters, Ladies and Gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to welcome you here this evening for another very joyful and very special occasion for the Nicaean Club. I'm sure that you would like me to thank on your behalf all those who have prepared and served our meal this evening. I think we've been very well looked after. I feel I should also thank the librarian and the staff of the Lambeth Palace Library for allowing us into this sacred space this evening. I know that they're always a little bit apprehensive that we're going to throw food at the books, but I can always assure them that the Nicaean Club is generally fairly well behaved, at least until this stage in the evening. It's a particular pleasure to welcome Bishop Huber and Frau Huber as our guests tonight. Bishop Huber has had a very, very distinguished career indeed in the Evangelical Church in Germany, both as a scholar and researcher, and as a bishop and a church leader, now holding the senior episcopal position in the EKD. He has contributed memorably and effectively to theological debate in general, to debate on public and ethical questions in particular, not only in Germany but in the whole European context. And as I can testify with great warmth of feeling, he has been a faithful friend to the Church of England and has furthered the relationship created through the Meissen Agreement with great enthusiasm, with great commitment. I have the happiest of memories of the time when we jointly chaired a meeting of the theological section of the Meissen Commission in Berlin some years ago as part of the commemoration of the centenary of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Bonhoeffer's work has been a focus for Bishop Huber's enthusiasm and research for many years, and it's been one of those areas where we have found a great deal of common ground and common appreciation. It's sometimes said, with sadly a degree of truth, that certainly in the last couple of hundred years, the Church of England has not taken its reformed partners on the continent of Europe with the seriousness they deserve. It has developed its own varieties of reformed Protestantism and has sometimes found that its most natural partner in dialogue is the Roman Catholic Church. And yet, if we look back to our Anglican origins, the sense of belonging to a conversation among what is sometimes what are sometimes wonderfully called the best reformed churches was very much part of the Anglican identity at the beginning. Facing, as we do, highly complex and rapidly changing societies, and facing them as churches deeply rooted in and involved in the political lives of our nations, it's more than ever important that the German Church and the Church of England develop not only a sympathetic and intelligent mutual understanding, but a capacity to speak together in the European context on many of the issues of the age. We've been speaking over dinner about some of those issues, about the issues of bioethics, about issues of economic ethics, all those matters which press so hard upon all of us. And I know that we share a concern that the churches in Europe, Catholic and Reformed, should together help Europe itself to form a sense of its moral identity and its moral vocation, so that the European Union becomes something just a little bit more than a financial convenience. The euro is no doubt a very important institution, but in and of itself, it doesn't create that shared moral vision. So the Meissen Agreement has, in the years past, been an opportunity for us to share experience between the English and the German churches, to share our perspectives and our vision, and to share something of what we believe we have to contribute to the ongoing conversation about the identity and the future of Europe itself, in a world of instability and violence and injustice. In the post-war period, our nations have grown together in any number of ways. We have, by the grace of God, been enabled in Europe to think about what reconciliation might concretely mean. We have something to share with the wider world beyond simply the euro. And that is why it is important that this particular conversation with our German brothers and sisters should continue, should be the focus of our energy and our commitment. And it's why I'm truly delighted to welcome you tonight, Wolfgang, in our midst as a valued friend and colleague, and to invite you to address us.
Dear friend and brother Owen Williams, Mrs. Chairman, honored guests, ladies and gentlemen, when Pope Paul VI visited the World Council of Churches in Geneva in 1969, he met the then WCC General Secretary, Eugene Blake, whom his colleagues called Jean. His Holiness reportedly began his address with the dignified sentence, "We are Peter." The General Secretary is said to have replied, "Call me Jean." I'm very grateful to have been invited to Lambeth Palace without having to deal with such subtleties of protocol. The fact that our personal friendship and cooperation is so fruitful and ongoing is based on the foundations that have been laid for us and on which we are glad to build. And it was already mentioned, and I'm very grateful, Rowan, that you mentioned it so clearly. Since 1988, we have been bound by the Joint Declaration of Meissen, with its unfolding of our common faith and its consequences for the communion of our churches. Therein we commit ourselves to give each other a share in our respective church life, to grant one another Eucharistic hospitality, and to strive for visible unity. Our regular theological conversations are leading us to increasing mutual understanding. Central theological topics are taken up again and again. Examples are the ministry in the church and training for this ministry, the relationship between ministry and Eucharist, or the ecumenical understanding of the authority and the use of Scripture. This month, a British-German symposium on church history is to take place in Berlin, entitled Sister Reformations, concluding with a joint service in Berlin Cathedral, where Bishop Nick Baines will be the preacher. These examples of our common work on fundamental theological questions illustrate the impact of the Meissen process for the life of our churches. However, our relations have long since gone beyond the stage of theological discussion alone. In the spirit of Meissen, many lively encounters are developing that are bringing together the parishes and regional churches from Germany and the dioceses of the Church of England. I am, of course, particularly attached to the twinning between London and Berlin, which I had the privilege of setting up with Bishop Richard Charters. A prime example is, however, the twinning between the Lutheran Church in Braunschweig and the Diocese of Blackburn, with its many visits, projects with confirmation candidates, and numerous joint services. With respect to these partnerships, we are very grateful that the Braunschweig Bishop Friedrich Weber is willing to take on the chair of the Meissen Commission on the German side. I'm sure that in cooperation with Bishop Nick Baines, he will take the Meissen process significantly forward on the path that lies ahead towards visible unity. Another field of our fruitful ecumenical fellowship is the rewarding fraternal cooperation between Church of England parishes and the German-speaking parishes in Britain. We are grateful for this daily relationship of trust which enables these German-speaking congregations, so closely linked to us, to carry out their mission of proclamation in an ecumenical spirit. It is still of great significance that these ecumenical bonds between our churches contribute to the process of reconciliation between our two peoples that has led us out of the guilt and burden of our history of hostility to a new community of peace and common responsibility. A few days ago, the 1st of September, we recalled the beginning of the Second World War, which began with Hitler's attack on Poland. Mourning and shame in view of the countless victims mingles with wonder and gratitude for the readiness to seek reconciliation that emerged from the rubble of that war. For the next few weeks, we will be remembering the gift of the peaceful revolution in East Germany and Eastern Europe 20 years ago, recalling that the European peace project, which arose in response to the destructive power of war, can now cover the whole European continent. That offers great opportunities to European churches, but also involves major commitments in their common responsibility for peacemaking. Looking back on the century of world wars, we must also, however, remember the peace initiatives with which far-sighted Christians in our two countries strove to anticipate the dynamic of violence and war. In 1908, 6 years before the beginning of the First World War, the Associated Council of Churches of the British and German Empires for Fostering Friendly Relations Between the Two People was founded. This was, in my view, a remarkable contribution in developing the work of peace building and friendship between our churches, a significant outcome being the friendship between Bishop George Bell and Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Both of them ecumenists, they made their own contribution to the founding of ecumenical organizations after World War II, which gave a hitherto unprecedented institutional shape of our ecumenical commitment. Our two churches are bound by a shared ecumenical experience and, at the same time, by a shared ecumenical responsibility. We look back with gratitude to the new ecumenical initiatives that arose from the upheavals of the age of world wars. The year 1925, in which the Nicaean Club arose, also featured the first World Conference on Life and Work in Stockholm, which was of particular ecumenical importance. In my personal files, I have the documents my mother brought back from this event, which, as a young student, she had attended with her father, who was a delegate in Stockholm in 1925. The impetus led much later to the founding of the World Council of Churches. We celebrated its 60th anniversary last year. It was followed this year by the 50th anniversary of the Conference of European Churches. The gratitude for these multilateral ecumenical organizations is combined with considerable concern about their future. It is all the more encouraging to note that a new process of reflection has been launched about their role and how to make them more effective. In our preparations for the assembly of the Conference of European Churches, and more particularly at the debates and decisions of the assembly itself, which took place in July this year in Lyon. We experienced mutual support and advice and a shared success in which the Church of England and the Evangelical Church of Germany cooperated very closely. The contributions of the churches together in Britain and Ireland, and particularly the Church of England, made a substantial contribution to the adoption in amended form of the EKD's original motion to fundamentally reform the Conference of European Churches by a majority of 90% of the delegates. In the next few years, we will have the job of putting this reform of CEC into practice. Let us collaborate to ensure that, in its work, the Conference of European Churches can concentrate on the particular opportunities available to multilateral organizations, namely promoting fellowship among one another and discovering and renewing elements of common spirituality. Conducting the debate about fundamental ethical orientations in such a way that it is heard in the cultures and societies of an ever more united Europe and contributes to their orientation. Gathering up the positions of the churches on important questions of European development so that they can be raised with greater effectiveness vis-à-vis the European institutions and in the general public of Europe. We are not guided here by an ideal of uniformity in ecumenism. Visible unity does not presuppose the disappearance of differences. Our ability to respect our differences and deal with disparities in a brotherly and sisterly way will be a particularly important contribution to the future of our continent and our world. After all, that shows what Christian churches, indeed religions in general, can contribute to the coherence of a society characterized by plurality. In the same way, in the World Council of Churches, we have great combined potential for helping to gain support for its work from the member churches and enabling it to deal with its agenda better and more effectively. During the meeting of the WCC Central Committee a few days ago, it became clear that the initiative to reform the Conference of European Churches will also have repercussions on the World Council of Churches. The prospects for the WCC were described in outline at its last assembly in Porto Alegre. The task of sharpening this, concentrating on the main points, and above all, of putting it into practice, has not been really tackled, however. I hope that the election of Olaf Hyksitveit as the new General Secretary and the ongoing process of reconfiguring the WCC will give it new impetus. A working group on governance, accountability, and staff policy has made proposals for drawing on the competences and resources of the member churches and thus raising the public profile and perception of the WCC. And to say it openly, that is urgently needed. The courageous term sister reformations has already clearly expressed the categories used today to consider the relationship between our respective churches dating from the Reformation. The closeness we have achieved can encourage us to regard the relationship with other confessional families from a common perspective. The churches of the Reformation are, like the Roman Catholic Church, churches of the West. Regardless of their theological differences, they have much in common culturally. At present, it is hard to recognize prospects of deepening their fellowship. The issues that can be explored by means of consensus documents seem to have been largely cleared up. We can together declare that the mutual condemnations of the Reformation century no longer apply to the present-day ecumenical partners. The difference that remain between the churches of the Reformation and the Roman Catholic Church are all the more serious. They relate, at least from our viewpoint, to the questions of how to understand ecclesial ministry. The lack of agreement in the understanding of ministry significantly hampers the mutual perception of the other as a church. This fact is, without any doubt, one of the obstacles for ecumenism in the first decade of this century. It is my hope that the second decade will witness the emergence of a different approach to this question. I am convinced that there can only be ecumenical progress when the ecumenical partners mutually respect each other's way of being church. The issue of the position and contribution of the Orthodox churches has been a special challenge in international ecumenism in the last few years. I am particularly hopeful due to the fact that outstanding Orthodox church leaders, including in particular the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople, Patriarch Bartholomew, and the Patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church, Patriarch Kirill, are convinced of the indispensable importance of the ecumenical challenge. We sensed effects of this conviction in the efforts to reform the Conference of European Churches, where constructive contributions were made by Orthodox churches and most particularly by the Ecumenical Patriarchate. Yet the picture of worldwide Christianity has dramatically changed within only a few decades. The number of members of charismatic movements and Pentecostal churches is rapidly growing on our planet. These developments are developing a considerable dynamism not only in Latin America, Africa, and Asia. Their influence cannot be overlooked in Europe either. We need a dialogue on the resultant theological questions. Only thus we can prepare ourselves and our congregations and provide theological guidance. The WCC also needs such contributions for its internal debate and in order to establish relations with these movements at the appropriate theological level. A core question occurs when we go a step further and look for a moment at the widest range of our responsibility for the moment, namely interfaith dialogue. It confronts the ecumenical community with comparable challenges. On the basis of our experience with this dialogue in Britain and Germany, in particular with Muslims, we have a considerable lot to contribute. We can also link up with the common experiences we gained in the trilateral dialogue with some institutions over the last years, and I see in this trilateral approach a very important element of our cooperation. Let the examples for that by side. My final question is, what is our image of ecumenism from which we look to in such reflections? What is our ecumenical vision? Many people describe this vision in terms of a unity that lies before us, which we have to strive for, and in view of which the division of Christianity is a scandal. In this context, they cite the plea in Jesus' high priestly prayer that they all may be one. Sometimes it seems to me that we even forget that this is a prayer. So strongly do we believe that visible unity is the result of our human striving. Personally, I would like to ask questions not just about the goal, but equally about the grounds of our ecumenical ties. The hymn to unity in the letter to the Ephesians sheds light on this issue. There is one body and one spirit, even as you are called in one hope of your calling. one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is above all and through all and in all. This biblical expression of faith testifies to an ecumenical reality that is given with our faith itself. The question to us then is whether we live up to this given reality or whether we fall short. Do we express this basis in the form of our church fellowship? Are we recognizably guided by God's one Spirit and are witnesses in our age to one hope? One Lord urges us to be one body. One faith commits us to being guided by one Spirit. One baptism makes us witnesses to one hope. The extolling of unity in the letter to the Ephesians culminates in the praise of the one God and Father. The Church is one in confessing Christ, in one faith and one baptism. In its witness, service and hope, the Church provides the basis for praising the one God who fills the universe and holds it all together. This biblical passage outlines an ecumenism of praise and thanksgiving to God. It does not begin with what is demanded of us ecumenically. Rather, it reminds us of what has been ecumenically entrusted to us. It first tells us what we are ecumenically before it demands what we are to become ecumenically. We here encounter a splendid, impressive ecumenism of the indicative, a grammatical term for that which is, not that which could or should be. An ecumenism grounded in the liberating gospel of God's grace in Jesus Christ begins as an ecumenism of indicative, not as an ecumenism of imperative. Remembering what has been entrusted to us all, we hear the call to join together in the body of Christ. The choice of this image reminds us that belonging together ecumenically does not mean uniformity. The letter to the Ephesians does not define this unity as a standardized definition of office and its relationship to the community, nor does it expect worship to take the same form at every place. The ecumenical litmus test is whether different persons and groups are guided by the same Spirit and testify to the same hope. They can only do so if they build on a firm foundation, if they are united in one baptism, share one faith, and witness to one Lord, the crucified and risen Christ. This is not about ecumenism from above, in which the oneness of God is projected onto the uniformity of the Church. Rather, it is about ecumenism from below, which makes room for diversity, but also trusts in the power of unity. From gratitude to the unity given in confessing Christ, we seek ways of bringing together our various gifts in order to witness to this unity together. That is a dynamic understanding of unity for which we have even had political equivalences in recent history. 20 years after the peaceful change of system in Europe, we gratefully confess that we were given a unity in diversity for which we had for a long time hardly dared to hope for. Giving it shape is the great political challenge confronting us in Europe, a process to which we as churches want to contribute. In such an ecumenical vision, diversity and unity, breadth and concentration can be connected with one another in fresh ways. The breadth of topics and networks need not be lost if we recall our common witness. Our different traditions need not fade or lose their own character if we together reveal the foundation on which we stand, one Lord, one faith, one baptism. The unity of the churches does not need to be reinvented. This unity is the ground on which we stand. In my view, this change of perspective is the decisive step towards the ecumenical reorientation that we need today. It will help here if we see our diversity not as a threat to unity, but as an expression of it. That is the kind of vision which I learned from our cooperation between the Church of England and the Evangelical Church in Germany. And therefore, I wanted to express my gratitude to this mutual learning process in our being on the way together. I'm convinced we have not only to contribute in very urgent issues of our day, we can also contribute to a new vision of what ecumenism is all about. And therefore, I thank the Nikean Club for the fact that you, since the year 1925, which has, as I explained, a certain importance for my personal history, that you, since this time, stand for an engaged and empowering ecumenism, and therefore I take my glass and say to the Nikean Club.
To the Nikean Club.